Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Myrna Culbraith. And Myrna has, of course, created the phonics game, and then now she's created something called Phonopoly, which is another means of teaching children and even adults how to read phonetically and spell phonetically. She writes the Star Trek books and really has a fascinating background. Myrna, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Oh, well, I'm always delighted to be with you, Dr. Stan. You do such good work, and it's, you know, it's appreciated, and I think people do appreciate it. I was noticing, just parenthetically, before we even get to whatever our main topic is tonight, I was noticing an article saying that Jeb Bush has filed a brief in the court case involving the woman in Texas. A while back when I was interviewing some of your guests, when you had a touch of laryngitis, I interviewed the gentleman whose topic that night was euthanasia and what's going on about that. And one of the stories was this rather terrible story about a woman's husband who got, give or take, $1 million in a lawsuit contending he was going to try to rehabilitate her after she had a severe brain injury. And he didn't spend it on her, and now he wants to get it himself by having her killed, basically, by the state. And the state has pretty much agreed to do it. So anyway, he was talking about that case, and I know that a lot of listeners called, wrote, argued from there and from other locations. I had another lady on from Judicial Watch who was upset about that as well.
Well, that, of course, probably was Wesley Smith you were talking to, and that
yeah,
was the
I
case
think that was
of,
Wesley Smith,
of
right.
Terry Schiavo, and, of course, her husband has a new girlfriend, and I'm sure he'd like to get his hands on the money, which he can't do as long as his wife is alive. So they were going to starve her to death, dehydrate her and starve her to death. But just within the last 24 to 48 hours, Governor Jeb Bush in Florida has intervened and said, well, we ought to see whether or not she can actually eat, if she can eat herself, you know, without a feeding tube, then maybe what they're doing is wrong. And, of course, I think she probably can. Anyway, that's the latest on that. And the latest quotation is a national crusade to save a Florida woman from a court-ordered death by starvation has finally moved Governor Jeb Bush to intervene. In a friend of the court brief filed last week, the governor asked that Terry Schiavo be given the opportunity to eat and drink on her own before a feeding tube is removed on October 15th. So I'm sure what you did on the program and what others have done really did create this sense of awareness. Enough pressure was brought to bear so that Governor Bush did what I think he should have done long ago, and that is said, we're certainly going to find out if this woman really is non-comitis mentis. And, of course, all the reports say she's not. So it's going to be interesting to see how that develops. But anyway, for those listeners out there, why Myrna very often covers for me when I take a short trip, and she'll be doing that again another couple of weeks. Anyway, this evening we're going to talk about the problem with our educational system. And, of course, the most important thing is for people to understand there is an organized, orchestrated, coordinated effort to dumb down our children, starting with reading, using a technique of reading that they know does not work. But you see, they really don't want well-educated children. And then they say, oh, isn't it terrible? Our kids are doing so much worse than the people over in Latvia and Lithuania. Give us more money. And, of course, more money is not going to solve the problem. They have to get back to basics. They know what they're doing doesn't work, and that's why they're using it. And until people understand there really are people out there who want to dumb down our children, nothing is going to change. And if you have your children in government schools, get them homeschooled, get them into a church school, get them out of the government schools if you care for them. We have to keep working to educate the people, but until the American people understand the truly diabolical nature of what we're up against and how it is funded by the great tax-exempt foundations and even by many of the people of great wealth in this country who have a different agenda. They want an all-powerful state, poorly educated people, and, of course, the loss of all individual freedom for everybody but themselves. Well, you know, you've been at the front lines of this battle for many years, Myrna. Why don't you pick up the story, and why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about John Dewey, the so-called father of progressive education, who over 100 years ago found that the methods of teaching reading that are used today didn't work, and just so he decided to implement them. Tell that story.
Well, you know, it is a very strange story, and Dewey is one of the really bad hats in intellectual history. I mean, he's about as black a hat as you could find, and he didn't look like it, you know. He looked like this nice little professorial guy doddering away there, writing these massive books and so forth. A critic made a very interesting comment about Dewey. He said, Dewey concealed his dynamite in a pile of dry hay. And that's about what happened. The books that he wrote, you know, you could get the sleepy tired syndrome really quickly reading his books, and it seems like just a kind of technical, philosophical gibberish. You know, people thought he was an okay writer in a technical and bookish sort of way. But what they didn't realize was how much he was slipping in under the transom with that way of writing. He was really saying, we don't want the individualized mind, we want the collectivized mind. We don't want readers, we want people who fit into our social system. And he literally did not want to spend the first 2-3 years of school teaching people, among other things, to read. He wanted them to fit into the group, to design their own activities, to run around and learn whatever they wanted to. By the way, by the 1930s, Dewey was even apologizing to some degree for the bad behavior that, as he correctly noted, people were seeing in the progressive schools. And he said, oh, well, it's better they should have bad behavior than that they should be regimented, basically. But what he did, and he did it over 100 years ago now, he tried a whole word reading method. And, you know, the controversy between whole word and phonics goes back even 100 years before that, or almost, and to the time of Horace Mann and to the time when the Owenite socialists realized that their method, their social system, as they called it, the word socialism hadn't been invented yet, their social system did not work and could not work with human nature as it was. So they had a really tough decision. Do we give up our social system, which we're very fond of, or do we have to change human nature? Well, it came firmly down on the side of we have to change human nature. And, you know, it didn't take much of a leap from there to say, well, if we're going to change human nature, you better get it while it's young. And so they targeted education. But at that point, I'm talking early 1800s, education, 1820-ish kind of time, education was very fragmented, and it was private. And it was all kinds of little schools, church schools, charity schools, schools supported by parents, schools supported by charitable organizations, schools attached to miscellaneous religious institutions, etc. But it was very good education, and everybody pretty much was in school. In a study in about 1820-ish in Boston, they found 96% of all kids of school age were in school. That's probably more than are in school now. I mean, certainly it's more than are in school after the eighth grade, when we lose about a third to half of kids, and then we report, you know, a third of the kids are vanishing between eighth grade and when they should have graduated high school, or even more in a lot of areas. And yet Houston reported a 1.5% dropout rate. Houston, where Secretary of Education Rod Paige had what was supposed to be the Houston miracle and catapulted himself to the Office of Secretary of Education on the basis of that. and at least one figure from that was so low that anybody ought to have raised eyebrows, let alone a conniption fit, about it. 1.5% dropout rate in Houston. You know it's got to be more than that.
Well, because liars don't figure, but figures don't lie, but liars figure, and they were all falsified. But I just wanted to point out to our listeners that Myrna was talking about the Owenites. Now, Robert Owen was a communist. He came to the United States back in about 1820, shortly thereafter. His father was very wealthy, and they set up a community, a commune, in a place called New Harmony in Indiana, as I remember. And this was to be the ideal communist society. Well, of course, communism doesn't work. I mean, it's a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory, but somebody always has to be in charge, and that's exactly what happened. The whole thing fell apart, and at that time, they decided that the only way that we were going to be able to make communism work in America or any other place was to get them, these people, when they were very young, to change the educational system. So, of course, Robert Owen created a secret society. And, of course, they began working to take over the educational system. Now, it took them, you know, from 1820, 1825, up until George W. Bush became the president, to centralize all power over education with the federal government so that they could have federal control over everything that was taught in our developmental schools. But there was a man named Rustus Brownston who was one of the disciples of Owen, and certainly was a, but he eventually became a Christian, and he wrote about the secret society that was formed to take over education. In fact, all of our history is secret societies, and the reason you never hear about them is because the secret societies have a stranglehold on the media in America today. And of course, they're the ones who own it, not the average reporter. The reason he has a job is because he's of a liberal bent, not because he himself is a conspirator. He's a victim of his education, and he's gone to schools who are financed by these people of great wealth to indoctrinate the people going through our universities in the radical left-wing socialist bent, exactly what Owen, Robert Owen, had planned back in the 1820s. So go ahead, Myrna.
And there were a few generations of these people. They succeeded after a fairly short time in getting a public school system established in Massachusetts. And they did do it from an underground position. At first, for a while, the Owenite socialists were putting out a little newspaper in their own name. And it had a few issues, and then it went out of print because what they realized was the mass of Americans were not at all interested in what they were talking about. And if they were to put their stamp on the movement for a centralized system of education, for state public education in Massachusetts or anywhere else, they knew that would be the kiss of death, because one of the things, they were coming from an atheistic position. It didn't go down too well with many Christians and or even Unitarians or miscellaneous Americans. So they knew they had to do it from an underground position, and basically they got other people to front for them. And the upshot was they did get a State Department of Education established in Massachusetts.
Now, was that Horace Mann played a part in that, didn't he?
Exactly. Horace Mann became the first Secretary of Education of Massachusetts. And he was a very active guy. He'd been a small-time bureaucrat and hanger-on around the political process there. Got very active. He went out and rode circuits around the schools, and he put in this, that, and the other. And he did something very interesting. He started the first teacher's college. Now, you know, teacher's colleges and universities, et cetera, to this day, are pretty harrowing places. I mean, they teach things that are clearly in violation of every bit of scientific research that's ever been done. And every bit of scientific research ever done shows that phonics is the only way to teach reading. And yet, teachers' colleges, et cetera, to this day, teach variations of the whole word, whole language method. And then they turn out teachers, not surprisingly, who teach it that way. And the poor teachers get into the classroom and find out it doesn't work. But they don't know why. They've been taught this is the way you should do it. And most teachers are people of reasonably goodwill, and they're out there trying. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't have gone into something dealing with kids. And many of them burn out very fast because the methods are rotten, and the teaching they got in teachers' college wasn't any good. And the people who go to teachers' colleges, by and large, have less in the way of academic qualifications than other college specialties, and so on. So teachers' college is a pretty bad place now. But the very first teachers' college, it was called a normal school in those days, the very first thing to educate teachers in the public schools in Massachusetts, put in the first year a whole word method of teaching reading, and for educational psychology, they had a course in phrenology, reading the bumps on your head to try to assess your character. And every, you know, there had been a speaking tour in Boston by the sort of the second founder of phrenology. The first one had died. A man named Spurzheim took over, came over here, did a lecture tour in Boston. A lot of people got very interested. You know, it sounded maybe like a semi-plausible theory. It was complete bunkum, but it might have sounded plausible. Everybody got pretty excited. I mean, you know, people who were inclined to get excited about that kind of thing got excited. One of them being Horace Mann. And he struck up a lifelong friendship with this Spurzheim. He sent Spurzheim to investigate schools in Europe and send him back notes on what to do or not do. And toward the end of Mann's and Spurzheim's life, Mann wrote to him and said, "Hey, come over here and I will make a home for you." In effect, we'll live out our years to the end of somebody's days here. I don't think it ever actually happened, but that was his offer. And so here's a man who's in charge of the public schools, who's committed to absolutely nutso theory of psychology. And one of the things that was in that theory of psychology was, well, you can maybe change human nature. So we got to study the bumps here to figure out what's wrong with people, and then maybe we can fix it or whatever.
But I think that the people have to understand that this has always been the purpose of education. Now, we had Christian education where, of course, the divinity of Christ and God were at the very, very center of our educational system, you know, during the early years of this republic. And then, of course, here are people who wanted to destroy that belief and, of course, wanted to use education to do it. And Horace Mann was around, what, about the 1830s, 1840s?
Yeah, right about that.
And, of course, 1848. Along comes Karl Marx, publishes Communist Manifesto. What's point number 10 in the Communist Manifesto? A free public education for every student. And then, of course, you know, not long after that, 40 years later, you have, of course, Edward Bellamy writing, Looking Backwards, calling for a world, a socialist world. And so all of this movement towards socialism is there. The first Socialist International is created in 1860. Or in 1861, certainly the Second International in the 1880s, the Fabian Socialist Movement in the 1880s, and of course, this whole idea that we are going to use education because we're going to transform society, because we will be the rulers and everybody else will be brought under our control. And the only way to do it, of course, is to not teach people how to read. And they had a hard time because a lot of the teachers recognized how ludicrous this was. Didn't they actually throw some of these techniques out?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Mann imposed the whole word method on the Boston and other Massachusetts schools, and after a few years it was very apparent to the teachers that this was, I mean, it was probably apparent immediately, but it took a few years to get cranked up to actually oppose it. And the schoolmasters wrote an open letter to Horace Mann saying, "This is absolutely crazy, we must end this system and go back to phonics." And but Mann was still in there pitching. His wife wrote the first whole word primer, by the way, or one of the first ones. And anyway, it's a puzzling story, but the essence of it is run, do not walk, and get something and teach your kid phonics.
Okay.
And or yourself.
We'll be back here in just a few moments. We have to take a little break for our listeners up there in the Great Northwest. The Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest this evening is Myrna Culbraith, and we're really talking about the history of education, the history of the use of the whole word method of teaching, and whether it's a run, Jane, run, or call it what you will. There's always been an effort to dumb down our students with a system that didn't work. Phonics was working. We had a 95% literacy rate in 1800. Today we have almost 100 million Americans who are either completely or partially illiterate. And of course this did not happen by accident, it happened by design, because there have always been these dark forces working within America who would utilize this country to use our military and financial strength to create this one world government. But you couldn't do it with an educated populace. They'd never go along with the wars, with the centralization of power, the loss of individual freedom, and certainly never go along with using their tax money to bring about this one world government and changing the world. And so we could really complete this long-range plan that goes back to the ancient mystery religions of antiquity of creating a world government. Well, we end up then, of course, doing away with the whole word method under the time of Horace Mann. And so then along comes John Dewey 50 or 60 years later, and he introduces this again in the early 1900s, doesn't he?
That's right. And Dewey, you know, he had many theories about education. He wrote prolifically. He lived for 90-something years. And he was lauded after a while by everybody and his brother-in-law, including the National Education Association. And Dewey, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, he started a laboratory school, he called it, at Chicago University. And he plunked some hapless kids into it, and he appointed as head of that school under him a Colonel Parker, not the one that made Elvis famous, but another Colonel Parker, who was the leading whole word advocate of his day. And, you know, whole word had kind of come and gone. And by the way, people may be puzzled by the fact that in the good part of the 1800s, even though there were public schools, some of them were little schools out on the prairie that parents just got together and paid a teacher or gave a room and board or whatever they did. And as the public schools grew, they, in most places, they did teach some phonics, and they used things like the McGuffey readers, which were phonics-oriented and which had real stories and real content and real literature. And by the fourth, fifth, sixth grade McGuffey readers, it's things like Shakespeare, Thackeray, Macaulay, Thoreau, etc. So people were really learning to read, and in the great mass, they were learning to read in those schools. And this continued, by and large, in public schools until about 1930. Now, Dewey had tried it in his laboratory school. He clearly saw that the whole word method did not work, but he wasn't really interested in having it work to teach kids to read for basically the reasons we're talking about. He didn't want high literacy. He said, well, you know, as educators, we can't be bothered with teaching mere knowledge. I mean, he would use phrases like mere learning or mere logic or mere literacy or mere whatever. There was a whole nest of these people, by the way. Dewey's mentor, a man named G. Stanley Hall, was also the mentor. These were his graduate students. Dewey was one graduate student.
You're going to have to hang on to that thought for just a moment. We'll be resuming our... there we are. And, of course, our guest this evening is Myrna Culbraith. We're talking about this effort to dumb down the American people. And, of course, in the 1800s, everybody went to school, and the reason for it was so that they could read God's Word. That was what was so important about being able to read. Then, of course, you could know what God told you through the Holy Scriptures about how you should live your life. And that was, of course, the major thrust. And even, of course, down the line when people started talking about public education, and one of the things that the advocates of public education said, well, you know, we may have 95% of our children in schools, but what about those other 5%? They're not going to be able to learn how to read God's Word. That's why we have to have public schools. And of course, the other side, our side, the religious people, foolishly agreed without realizing the people on the other side really weren't interested in teaching children to read God's Word because they hated God's Word and everything represented there. They had a different agenda. But so we get the public school system increasingly coming in and replacing the church school, replacing the private school. And then, of course, with this, of course, comes the change of the attitude of our people. As instead of educating our young people, we indoctrinate them and lay the groundwork for where we are today.
Yeah, and, you know, what was really so dramatic, you know, I started to say the students of G. Stanley Hall, who was Dewey, as a matter of also one of his graduate students and a cohort of Dewey, was a man named Huey, H-U-E-Y, and Huey wrote a book on the whole word method, I mean, enthusing and evangelizing about it, and oh, how it would free the kids from this terrible effort of learning phonics, and it was okay if they, never mind if they misread words, because by that time it was very clear to everybody. He wrote it in 1908, and it was already clear to Dewey in 1897 that the whole word method didn't work, and he admitted it. Dewey said, "We do not claim," he's substantially paraphrasing him just slightly, "we do not claim that by the old new method," meaning antiphonics, whole word, "the kids will learn to read as early or as well as by the old method, but we want to use the new method anyway," which I think is one of the more evil sentences in the English language. I mean, he knew he was crippling kids, and he wanted to do it because he wanted to focus on fitting them into the new social order and having them learn in school to be part of a little society like the Owenites wanted to have at New Lanark. And he thought, in the schoolroom should be this new society, aborning, and that's where kids should get used to and get used to fitting into the group. And they should have to look to the group for whatever they knew or thought they knew. And so it didn't bother him if the kids couldn't read the word off the page and they had to ask the teacher, or they stalled out completely, or they didn't read at all. That did not bother him. Mere learning wasn't his problem, even though he was allegedly the great philosopher of education. So he knew in 1897 it didn't work. 1908, Huey wrote this book enthusing about the whole word method and saying, if a kid guesses pony instead of horse, that's fine because he's gotten the meaning. Well, excuse me, but pony is not a horse. And they knew by that time that it led to guessing of words, complete total other words, and was there no logic to it, no comprehension, by the way. I mean, Huey acted as if they would get the meaning of the sentence without getting the words somehow. And, of course, you can't do that. I mean, whatever the words are, that's what where the meaning is. So they, by 1929, not only had they done this, but they had gotten a whole series of readers put together by one of their number, William S. Gray, who wrote the Run Jane Run books, the O.O. Look Look, the Scott Forsman readers. And the whole intent of those readers is to teach memorizing whole words, and by the way, a little bit of fitting into the community and all of that good stuff too, but especially to present just a little bit of whole words for them to memorize and never mention that, by the way, the letters are made up of sounds, and the letters stand for sounds, you know, which letters stand for what sound, you can read any word. No, they wanted to teach English as if it were Chinese, as if each word were a picture. Well, perhaps not surprisingly, that sent the effort to the picture half of the brain, which is the right half, which doesn't even speak English. So now they're busy teaching reading to the half of the brain that cannot even talk, and then they wonder what happened.
Well, I think
anybody's got a problem.
Right, I think it's an amazing thing that they've been able to get away with this, and the parents haven't risen up in, just in revolt against this whole public school system. But sometimes it's easier just to send your child off to school and not worry about it. And after all, it's very difficult for people to believe that there could be evil out there. There could be people who are intentionally wanting to harm our children, not the average teacher, but there are people who understand that whole word doesn't work, and that's why they're using it. After all, they don't want an educated populace, not if we're going to have a new world order and a new world religion. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're one of our regular listeners, we hope many of you will believe that there is enough wisdom and the information you hear here, that the speakers know what they're talking about and that America's in real trouble, that behind everything going on is a spiritual battle for the souls of mankind and for the survival of America, because America is the key to what happens in the world. And if America falls economically, morally, spiritually, why, the whole of Western civilization will be destroyed. And we are the bulwark, and you are on the front lines of the battle. If you'd like to become part of our team, as you know, we spend 5 hours every day on various networks, by shortwave, by radio, by certainly internet, by satellite, talking to people not only here in the United States but throughout the world. And if you'd like to become part of our team, we'd love to hear from you. And for a suggested gift, why, you can join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and you'll get our 4 best tapes of the month. You'll get our monthly newsletter. And if you'd be interested in knowing more about the Radio Liberty family of supporters, why not give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Now, we do put out a monthly newsletter, as I mentioned, and if you'd like a free copy of that, the September newsletter, I think, is well worthwhile, because it tells you what really happened on the morning of September 11th from an entirely different angle. It really is the testimony of Mindy Kleinberg, who lost her husband in the North Tower that morning. And, of course, she testified before the investigating committee in March of this year back in Washington, D.C. And, of course, any of the testimony that was worthwhile was immediately censored by the media, and the average individual has never heard of Mindy Kleinberg. She doesn't get on the front pages of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. In fact, she's not even mentioned on the back page under the pot roast ad because, of course, they don't want you to really know what happened that morning. But September newsletter is her complete testimony plus my commentary on it. So if you'd like, of course, to get a copy of that letter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And you can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day and not get anything accomplished. You can hear all sorts of archive programs. This program will be archived there as well if you want to hear it again. And then, of course, you can pull down our newsletters, and the September newsletter will be there. You'll have our permission to copy anything there, copy the programs, copy the tapes, distribute them. Help us reach the American people while we still have time. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, of course, is Myrna Culbraith. And we're talking about, of course, the tragedy of what's happened to our educational system. And of course, once they had destroyed the ability of so many of our children to read, and of course, some children can get by. They can sort of struggle with a whole word. But, of course, they're never going to be good readers, and they're never going to be good spellers, because the two go together. You've got to be able to use phonics to be able to spell and to pronounce words correctly, and just sort of guessing at the word is not the way to go. So why don't you pick up the story from there, Myrna?
Well, that's right. And what unbeknownst to a lot of people, and I run into a lot of people now, of course, I'm out in the world talking to people about various things from business to soup to nuts, and most of the people that I talk to, if I tell them the new brain research shows whichever half of the brain thinks it's supposed to be doing a job will try to do it, whether it's any good at it or not, even if it's lousy at it. And what they have done by teaching the whole word method as if the words were pictures is, in effect, they have engaged the wrong half of the brain. They have given it to the right half and said, here, this is your kind of job. You deal with the pictures, you deal with the words. Well, that might have been okay, who knew, but right half of the brain doesn't speak English, doesn't speak language, doesn't know what a word is. So now it's busy trying to deal with something it's totally incompetent to deal with, so then it has to go over and try to consult the left side of the brain where you do talk. First thing they ever learned about left brain, right brain, was languages on the left. And now it's got to go over and say, hey, what does this word mean? And then back to the right to get the next word, and back and forth, and back and forth. And I mean, it even sounds like it would make you sleepy or tired or bored. And it does. Well, and any executive group I ask, after I explain that a little bit, do you ever get sleepy, tired, bored? Generally speaking, it's over half of the hands that go up, and I'm sure there are a few that are dogging it and get sleepy, tired, but are not admitting it.
Well, basically, they've done these scans. They can actually measure what's going on in the brain. And isn't it true that with these special scans now, if you are, of course, reading with a look-see method, they can actually show that the right side of the brain lights up. And, of course, if you're reading as you should, they see the left side of the brain lights up. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. And a time or two when I've filled in for you, I think not on the evening program, however, I've had Dr. Sally Shaywitz, the head of the longtime dyslexia project at Yale University Medical School, and they are among the centers that can now look into the brain with brain scans while somebody is reading or doing reading-related activities. And that's exactly what they see. If a person is reading well and easily and is in good shape, three areas on the left side of the brain light up, including one that's probably responsible for automatic processing, which is kind of at the back of the brain. And on the other hand, if a person is labeled as dyslexic or has deep trouble or can't read much or reads okay but gets terribly tired or has all these symptoms, then what they're seeing is two big areas in the right half of the brain are lit up, and one in the left, and the whole thing going kind of berserk and working about four times too hard. I mean, four times average. Some people are five, six, eight times too hard. And then the real zinger is now they can see what I've been saying to you from time to time for a number of years. I said that I've seen this sleepy, tired syndrome, as I call it, clear up completely, and clear up even in people in their 50s, 60s, and beyond. And let alone their 20s, 30s, 40s, and kids who are probably going to be labeled dyslexic, but even doctors and lawyers and engineers who, yeah, they're surviving, but they get sleepy, tired, bored. Classic case being the guy who came in who was a dentist who went back to law school. It was the first time I saw this. He'd gone back to law school in his 50s, passed the law school, passed the bar, came in inquiring about our weekend seminars. And he said, you know, I had to get the law degree reading 5 minutes at a time, getting up, pounding myself on the back to try to wake up. And if I try to read at night, I just conk right out. Could you help me with that? You know, spelling is lousy, too, and all that. But I guess I could live with that, but this sleepy, tired stuff is killing me. So I didn't know, and I said I didn't. And I said, it will certainly help spelling comprehension. Might as well take it. And he did, and he played just the first two out of five main games. Phonicsopoly has 7 games, a couple of them are bonus games, one on spelling, one on everything you always wanted to say but were afraid to pronounce, and it still has the 5 basic, which are not all that basic, games. But all of phonics is basic, really. I mean, there are only 40 sounds, there are only about a dozen main rules and a couple minor ones, and you learn all of that by playing a few board games in Phonicsopoly. And anyway, this dentist played the first two games. He went home that night. For one reason or another, we didn't get to the third game, which I would have been a little less surprised, because that's really got a lot of zinger stuff in it that everybody doesn't know, basically, including teachers and linguists and whoever typically doesn't know that, but it's all very simple once anybody will bother to tell you. But he didn't get that far. He got the first two games where we especially stressed sound it out one sound at a time, even if you know the word, especially if you know the word. And that was all he did. He went home. And he thought, well, I better get back with a good night's sleep. I'll just read for 5 minutes. It'll knock me right out. And he picked up a book, confidently expecting to put himself to sleep. Well, no such luck. He wound up reading all night long. Came in the next day telling this story and said, you know, I might have to prop my eyes open with toothpicks later, but I sure kept them open last night for the first time in my life. Well, I have since seen that happen to a lot of people. And I eventually doped out, and I said, I think when they're teaching whole word, they're teaching it to the wrong half of the brain. That's what's causing this, and you can rewire the brain, and here are the people who've done it.
All right, well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how a Phonopoly or Phonicsopoly works and really what it is, because it's really a board game, very, very similar to Monopoly. And yet, of course, here is an opportunity while you're having fun and playing a game and trying to, of course, beat the other people, you're learning the very elements or the basis of the phonics part of our language. So could you explain it to our listeners?
That's right.
What Phonicsopoly is?
Yeah, it's it's different levels of board game. They all play kind of like Monopoly. They have a board and flexible playing boards, so they don't weigh 40 pounds. You get them all back to front on flexible sheets, and you get some little card decks that are playing pieces on the board, plus you get actual little playing pieces that move around the board. Put your playing pieces on the A space, on the go space, in effect, and roll the die. And then, unlike Monopoly, you're not quite stuck with that roll of the die. You can either go that number of spaces and take the space just by giving the sound or giving the information that's on that space as it gets a little more complex in later games, or you can draw a card, and you have a choice to draw a card each time. Well, if you draw the card, A, it'll teach you something. B, it'll give you a choice, typically, of three places to take on the board. And you're trying to get the most real estate on the board and the most cards to win. And so the card will give you a choice, maybe, and if some of the spaces are twice as valuable as other spaces, so you can develop a little strategy on this. And then as you continue drawing cards, you can kind of use the cards like houses or hotels and build them on your property, and then people have to pay you more rent when they land on it. So it's a really interesting board game, but then it has multiple levels. And you start in the same place with the first game, whether you were a kid or you're that attorney who had sleep retireds or anybody else, because that's where you have to start with phonics, the basic sounds, but you get a large chunk in the very first game. It turns out there are about 1 million words in the English language. It's on the simplest level. If you have to try to memorize 1 million words, lots of luck. You could be Einstein. The brain is just not set up to do that. The brain can maybe learn about 1,500 different individual symbols. If it's got to learn hieroglyphics or Chinese, that's just about the limit of what it can learn, maybe a couple thousand, but some say 1,500. And so you obviously can't even make a dent on the whole English language. So why English is what it is and can be what it is it's not hieroglyphics. It's not Chinese. It's an alphabetical language, and the alphabet was a huge breakthrough where they learned letters have sound. They invented little symbols and said, instead of having a whole word, let's have this stand for the sound we make when we say this word, and let's have these little individual sounds. It's like inventing the printing press for your voice. I mean, remember when they invented movable type and now you could print anything instead of the monks having to draw it out by hand in the monastery? Well, it was kind of like the invention of the alphabet was kind of like the printing press of reading. And all of a sudden, everybody, including the dockhand that the Phoenicians needed to have check off an invoice or a bill of lading, you could teach the dockhand to read in a day once they invented the alphabet. And that's what we're doing with Phonixopoly. You play the game. It's fun. In the very first game, there are only 40 sounds in the whole English language. The first game, you have learned and cleaned up and gotten just right 31 of the 40 sounds. You only have 9 sounds to go, and you just played one game. Next game, you get the most important rule about vowel sounds and how you know when it makes which sound. For example, first game takes up the short vowels like a for a and e for e and I for I, ah for o and for u. And there's one of those short vowel sounds in 9 out of every 10 English words. And then you got all the consonant sounds, including even going a little beyond the alphabet. We have 4 combinations that are like 4 more letters of the alphabet, th, sh, wh, and ch. And they each make a sound. In fact, TH makes a couple sounds, really a B sound, and the one that's just breathy. And so 31 sounds, counting the letters of the alphabet and the 5 that are made by those double trouble kinds of sounds. And once you know that, you can sound out any word of that type in the whole English language, meaning at least tens of thousands of words, probably more like 100,000 words. So right in that one game. And then the next game, the most important rule about long vowels. And long just means when a vowel sounds like its alphabet name. So the long sound of A is A, the long sound of E is E, and so forth. Well, you need to know then when it's short and when it's long, and there's a rule. And the first part of the rule is, let's say you put an E on the end of a word. Let's say you have the word mat. You put an E You know, the A is being short, like the A sound. Put an E on it, what happens? Well, some people know what happens and some don't, but what happens is the E is silent, but it reaches over in effect and makes the A say its name. All the rest of the sounds stay the same, so you still have M, but now instead of A, you have A, so now you have M, A, mate. And it works that way with every vowel, mat to mate, kit to kite, cot, cot, not to note, let's say, cut to cute. It works with all five vowels. The E makes the vowel in front of it say its name. And then there's another part of that rule. In effect, if even if you put two vowels side by side, generally speaking, the first one says its name, and the second one is silent. So you have a second half to that game that shows that rule. And you have now, within that game, the second game, you start getting little cards that will tell you the rule. Pops up a trick of the trade card, tells you the rule. You don't have to go look it up in a book or anything. It's right there, and it's a playing piece in the game. You get it, figure out what the rule means, you find a word that fits it, and you get to take that card, word card. So you're, and again, helps you to win. So you're certainly going to learn this, and then after a while you get some land grab cards that will let you take spaces and cards away from other players, and you read them and figure out what they'll take. So you're building comprehension. By the third game, it's things that commonly most teachers don't know, most bright adults don't know, most doctors don't know, and yet they're things that we needed to know to really be good readers, good spellers. Some of us got enough words memorized that we kind of survived. But unless people got phonics, you know, I lucked out, my Kansas family taught me some phonics, taught me to read when I was 2 years old. Otherwise, I would have been in the same soup as everybody else. And kids I went to school with were, I saw they were not learning to read, but I didn't know why for about another 20-something years. But it's truly remarkable how bad it is in the schools. On the other hand, how easy it is to fix. What I've described, you know, if you spent 45 minutes even playing the first game of Phonicsopoly and another 30, 40 minutes playing each of the other games, or however long you want. I mean, you could spend a little longer than that, but if you need to cut it off after a certain period, you will have gotten the point of the game, you can go on to the next game. So however much time you're willing to spend, and you know, people get a little antsy and think they've got ADD, okay, do it short, but do it. And do at least the basics of each game. You will find by the second, third game, most people have gotten over the sleepy, tired syndrome. By the third game, if not long before, people's jaws kind of drop open and they say, wow, why didn't somebody teach me that a long time ago? And they didn't. There's a rule that I commonly cite that it works on about 1 out of 4 words in the whole English language, and nobody knows it. I mean, essentially, for many years, I asked everybody I ran into, do you know or could you figure out a rule that this would go by? And for a long time, I got 3 answers. One was my writing partner that I write Star Trek books with, among other things, and Phonicsopoly now, and the Phonics game. And before we hooked up, I had gotten onto the Phonics bandwagon, and then she had not known what was the problem until I brought it to her attention. But and then when I asked her this question, she had not heard the question, but she figured it out. And then I hung it on Gene Roddenberry, who also had not heard the question. And I'm here to tell you that if Gene hadn't heard a question, boy, it wasn't being asked. And he didn't know, but he sat down and he gave himself examples, and he figured it out, bless his heart.
Well, I think that it's important that basically there are 12 rules that you have to know, and they're all here in the Phonicsopoly and the Phonopoly. And so you go through them, and suddenly they all make so much sense, but nobody ever teaches them. And this is the real tragedy, is that they're not teaching the things, at least in most schools, that our children need to know to be able to read, to be able to spell, to be able to pronounce words normally. So here's a wonderful way to get them. It's called Phonicsopoly, and we do that is available through Radio Liberty if you're interested, simply by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But you can go up on our website at radioliberty.com, and you'll see we have a section there on Phenopoly. And you know, one of the most interesting things to me and really rewarding things to me, Myrna, is when somebody who's an older individual, 50 or 60, calls and says, I didn't get that for my children or my grandchildren. I got that for me, and I'm going through it again. I learned so much the first time. Have you heard that?
Oh, yes, all the time. And I think that's so exciting, too. I would say, you know, a very large part of when every now and then I take a phone line from our call center personally just to be able to get acquainted and kind of hear what people are saying and feeling and doing and so forth. Many, many of the people I talk to are older, and when I say older, anywhere from 40, 50, 60, 70, or however old they are. But many of them are saying, you know, I need this for myself. Yeah, maybe I'd like it for a kid too, but mostly I need it for myself. And many times they don't have a kid. Some people say, could I play this by myself if I need to because I live alone? Yes, you could. And you can. All what you need to do is just don't give up the game element. Just invent an imaginary player, your imaginary Uncle Harry, or play it with Dr. Stan mentally or whoever you want to. But play it because the game element is important. And by the way, sometimes people have a question about this, or they have somebody that's struggling with this, and they might like to have a chance to talk to me or meet me or one thing or another. You know, I'm reasonably accessible. I'm every now and then I'm out on a public appearance or something. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be at a store on the Santa Monica Promenade Mall this Saturday from 1 to 3. People happen to be in Southern California. Santa Monica Mall is a store called Puzzle Zoo. And I'm going to be there from 1 to 3 with a free testing deal where you can have a little 5-minute test and find out, are you reading with the wrong half of your brain, or what grade level is the kid reading on, or is it really ADD, or is it something else? So if anybody's interested in that, or they want to get a Star Trek book signed, I'm easy. But I would urge you, you know, Dr. Stan is really out there battling for all of these causes and for things that he thinks are important and that are obviously important, including the survival of this country as a free individual country. And he was mentioning earlier his newsletter, which is very interesting. He's kind enough to send it to me, and I read it faithfully because it's got information you typically won't find anywhere else. So I would urge people, you know, getting Phonixopoly through Dr. Stan helps to support his ministry, which I approve of. It's doing that, and I'm glad it helps. And at the same time, you'll do the single best thing that you've probably ever done for your family, even if you don't think you have big problems. This is information that's the whole logic behind the English language for reading, for spelling. It will give your brain such a treat. And what it does, I mean, to finish the punchline on the brain stuff that Dr. Shaywitz has been saying, and not only her research center, but others now, too, are able to look into the brain. Well, when they see their brain reading badly, reading with the wrong half of the brain, guess what happens when they just teach phonics? Not even by as nifty a method as Phonixopoly, but nevertheless some phonics. It changes the brain and rewires it completely to the good reading, left side, left brain pattern. And it's as good or better than the people who were always better than average good readers.
And you know, I think that's the most amazing thing, that you can undo all the harm that has been intentionally done to a child's brain simply by teaching them phonics. And they had to work very hard to confuse this whole issue. As with mathematics, as with so many things going on in the world today, they intentionally complicate it and conceal the truth. And once people begin reading phonetically, why you shift from the right brain to the left brain, and they actually see that on the scan, don't they?
That's right, they do. They can see it on the scan. They see it's complete and total. I mean, the bad group came up to as good or better than the good group going in. And they see it on the scan. It literally moved it over to the left side of the brain. And I've been speculating that that was happening for years. I couldn't have proved it till recently. But they've proved it. And by the way, the last time I had Dr. Shaywitz on, I knew of at least studies that went up to late teenage years where that happened, and I asked her the last time, does it work for adults too, or do you have the evidence now? I mean, I know that it works, but it does the research body of evidence know that it will work for adults too? And she said, yes. So in a word, the word from Yale University Medical School and other places is, you can rewire the brain. And incidentally, all the other research is showing too, the brain is very changeable, very rewirable, up into and including old age. And so don't write yourself off if you happen to be a little slightly older age category. You know, people are living many more decades now than they used to. And chances are you've got a huge number of decades and years ahead. You might as well live them as an avid reader that loves to read, doesn't get tired, reads all night if they want to, you know, reads whatever they read, you know, reads on the bus, reads on the train, reads wherever you go. Because it's such a so much more interesting world. We've had people like that. Lately, I've told of an engineer who came in. He was in really bad shape on reading, worse than a lot of people. And in fact, on this little one word at a time reading test without picture, paragraph, context, he scored on a 4.5 grade level. And I was telling the story of a nuclear designer who was major design team head for the San Onofre nuclear plant, who years ago had scored on about a 5.4 grade level as a nuclear designer. And this new engineer, James, said, well, I'll go you one better than that. I, who just scored on this fourth grade level, I know how to crank up a nuclear power plant. And James is a bright engineer. It's not that he's an idiot. And you people would not notice it in his work, except maybe on the writing front. His spelling was pretty bad, and he lost an extremely good job when he was the third top engineer in a major technical company that had about 25 engineers. And then they had to downsize to one engineer, and it was not him because he couldn't spell and couldn't really think well enough on paper to write the technical reports. Well, he played one game of Phonicopoly, he got over the sleepy tired. He played two more games, and he always would drag home magazines and books that he wanted to read, but he'd read one paragraph and his brain would just zone out and he'd quit. And now, when I interviewed him on a different radio show, that after he'd done the third game, he said, you know, I have to apologize. I would have done more games of Phonicopoly, except, and I will do them, but right now I'm just so busy reading. And he said, I bring home a magazine. I used to bring home one and read a paragraph, and 3 months later I'd tell my wife to take it to the audience. Somebody might as well get some good out of it. Now I bring it home, I read it cover from cover by the next day, and I say, you might as well take it to the office now because I've finished it.
Well, I think that's amazing, amazing. And, of course, we've heard the same sorts of reports from people who actually use Phonicopoly. We're out of time, Myrna.
Oh,
thanks very much for being with us. And
oh, delighted.
We look forward to talking to you off the air here real soon.
Oh, wonderful.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye-bye. And well, this is Dr. Stan. And, of course, I just want to tell you that if you'd like to know more about Phonicopoly, go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, or you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, but I think our children deserve better than they're getting in government schools. And if you really want to know what they're doing, we've got all sorts of books. In fact, I give you a couple of books with the Phonicopoly, telling you how they have deliberately dumbed down our children, written by people who've studied it, taking the words of the people on the other side. It's a criminal activity, but of course, tragically, why most people have no idea what's happening. So, well, until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again. This is Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and views of our callers. And, of course, we'll welcome calls this hour at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Craig Austin, and we're going to be talking about the book, The Homosexual Agenda, Exposing the Principal Threat to Religious Freedom Today. Craig, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
In fact, I know Alan Sears. Of course, are you with the Alliance Defense Fund?
Yes, I am. I'm the Vice President of Creative Services for the Alliance Defense Fund.
All right, fine. And of course, this basically is going into the background of the homosexual agenda. There was a planned, coordinated effort to make homosexuality acceptable here in our society. And, of course, with that comes an attack on traditional marriage. With this comes, of course, their efforts to utilize the AIDS epidemic to their own advantage. And, of course, mm-hmm. the great tragedy is if you really care about homosexuals, you're going to tell them what they're doing is killing them. Almost a quarter of a million homosexuals have already died of AIDS because, of course, they've been told by their leaders and by the media and, yes, even by some churches, well, what you're doing is perfectly all right. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with it, and there is something wrong with it. Not because I say it is, but because they're dying and because God says it's wrong. And when we begin making up our own rules, why, of course, society begins falling apart. So, Craig, you've done a magnificent job in this book. I'm really very impressed by it.
Well, thank you very much. It was not an easy book to write, but we felt very strongly that this book needed to be written because nothing had been written that really spelled out in plain truth where the homosexual activists want to go.
And of course, you go into the background of the books that have been written by homosexuals, by Marshall Kirk and Hunter mm-hmm. Manson, and their book, Overhauling of Straight America, and another book, After the Ball, really lay out a 6-point program on how they were going to change America. They followed the Mein Kampf, and of course, they really used the same techniques that Hitler did. It's all written out exactly what they were going to do, how they were going to do it, and with the help of people of great wealth and many great foundations and corporations pouring countless millions of dollars into the homosexual movement, mm-hmm. why they've accomplished in changing, they've really changed the outlook of the American people, haven't they?
Yes, they have. They basically said they would stage a war of propaganda, and that's what they have done, for the last decade, to basically totally change how Americans believe about homosexual behavior, to convince them that, homosexual behavior is not only acceptable, but in the most extreme cases is almost preferable to heterosexual behavior. And they basically, flat out said, this is a war of propaganda, and we're going to use lies to advance our cause. And that's what they have done.
And, of course, they've had the full help of the people who make the television programs, the mm-hmm. full help of Hollywood, the full help of the media here in the United States. And you will never see any articles about how homosexuals are, what their sadism and masochism mm-hmm. and pedophilia. And when homosexuals kill somebody, why, that's never mentioned. But when Matthew Shepard was killed by a couple of people who certainly weren't Christians at all, they mm-hmm. were drunken slobs,
right.
Rather evil people, that, of course, was used, of course, to condemn all Christians for creating a climate of hate. And yet, of course, it's just the opposite. If you care about homosexuals, you got to tell them what they're doing is wrong and there is a way out.
That's what Christ's love commands us to do. He commands us to go to the sinner and point out where their behavior is, taking them to their, self-destruction. And with Christ's love, to share the good news with them. And, when Christ gave us the example, when he dealt with the woman, you know, caught in adultery. You know, he loved her, but he said, go and sin no more. And that's the area where, you know, the homosexual activists, they don't want their behavior, quote, they stigmatize, they don't want to hear that it is a sin. But the bottom line is, if they're going to get the love and the healing they really need, we need to keep our religious freedom so we can share that love with them. Because ultimately, what they seemingly hate the most is what they need the most.
And yet, of course, our Supreme Court now is going right along with the rules over in Europe and the European
yes.
Union and the United Nations Charter. And it won't be long before it will be illegal here in America to say that homosexuality is wrong, just as it is in Canada and in so many other countries where you can be put in jail for saying homosexuality is wrong. You know, and of course, I think what people really don't understand is that this is really a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield, and there really are evil people. There is a satanic spiritual force behind this, and it dominates almost every aspect of the world today. And our churches aren't even addressing that.
No, they're not. Churches have either not addressed it at all, you know, or if it's just chosen to ignore the issue. Or in some liberal churches, they have bought in to the whole arguments from the homosexual activists but then a lot of these churches are ones that threw out the gospel years ago anyway.
Well, because they pretty well destroyed the Catholic Church. They infiltrated the Catholic seminaries. They drove the people who were straight out of the seminaries. And, of course, they've discredited the Catholic faith. And, you know, of course, a lot of Protestants sort of snicker and say that's too bad. But the same forces are at work within the Protestant Church as well. We better understand that both branches of Christendom are under a terrible attack today.
Yes, they are. And that was a deliberate strategy from the homosexual activists to infiltrate, you know, the churches that they thought might be sympathetic to their cause, to cause disruption, and then also, as they said, to muddy the moral waters then to make, you know, the churches that did take a biblical stand look like, as Kirk and Nathan said, antiquated backwaters.
And of course, really, to make us to appear to be haters and bigots,
right.
And
mm-hmm.
These Christians who disapprove of homosexuality, they're the problem. It's not homosexuals. It's the people who disagree with them. And of course, they're undereducated, easily led,
yeah.
Extremely gullible, bigoted people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, they're, you know, it's this whole stigmatizing of a group. I mean, basically trying to marginalize a group of people, which we have seen throughout history, ultimately leads to, you know, the persecution of that group that is stigmatized.
And, of course, we're talking about Christians. We're not talking about the
right,
homosexuals.
Yes, we're talking about Christians. Yeah.
And, of course, the homosexuals are the ones who are doing this, are coordinating this. And it is the theoreticians, the forces behind this. We find out as you read your book that American Airlines, United Airlines, IBM, many of our great corporations are funneling all sorts of money into the homosexual movement, as well as many of the great foundations. In fact, I was just reading something today put out by the Population Research Organization that USAID, United States Aid and International Development, corporation funded with your tax money is pushing homosexuality throughout the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they doing that?
Well,
they don't reproduce. And of course, that's great
yeah.
for population control. But if you understand the depravity, which is what homosexuality is, why we are, with our tax money, promoting homosexuality, but of course we could never promote Christianity.
No, we can't promote Christianity, or we can't promote, you know, things like abstinence or so forth. That, you know, that is, you know, being exclusionary, you know, or, you know, being unrealistic, as they like to say. But I think the other thing is, what we see in this book is homosexual activists have really gotten themselves into pretty much all corridors of power in the United States, whether it's the media, corporate America, in, you know, the church, wherever. They have really, they've gotten in there and then have totally transformed those institutions and used them for their, to advance their agenda.
Amen to that. Well, now let's go through this. You actually, of course, have sections in here talking about how they've actually used television programs like Will and Grace and some
yes.
other others.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in fact, I mean, they, you know, the media was a big part of their strategy. They said they would wage a media campaign, and part of their strategy is to make homosexuals look good and to make, you know, heterosexuals, you know, look like the bumbling people, and especially make Christians look bad. You know, Michael Medved had a great quote. He said, you know, if you watched TV today, you would be, if Martian watched TV, he would become convinced that there were more homosexuals in America than there were evangelical Christians, because it's just all over the TV, and there's never any a negative portrayal. It's always, you know, the homosexuals are the characters that are with it, who, you know, they're the smart ones, they're the bright ones, and it's the heterosexuals that need to be fixed, and the Christians, they're just those, you know, ignorant people there who need to be re-educated.
And you give example after example of that, going to some of the programs on MASH.
Right.
And how there is a program of demonizing Christians, but they would never demonize a homosexual.
Oh, no. They would, you know, because they, you know, they would never do that because it would just, you know, one, they would just quake in fear of the, you know, the tremendous backlash they would get. And also, I mean, homosexuals just have such an incredible presence in Hollywood. I mean, they always did, but in the past 20 to 30 years, they've really started to use Hollywood to aggressively, push their agenda.
And, of course, you even go into some of the questions that they will ask our children today,
right.
Students about, you know, what do you think caused your heterosexuality?
Mm-hmm.
When did you first decide you were heterosexual?
Mm-hmm.
This is on page 62.
Right.
Do you have that handy? Could you sort of talk about that? Because all these questions are really aimed at causing people to wonder maybe they ought to try homosexuality. They might like it. They're giving this in our public schools without the permission of our parents.
I know, and so many parents are ignorant, they do not know what's going on. But this is very much of the homosexual strategy. They know if you get the young kids at an early enough age, you can, one, you know, just create tremendous confusion in their brains about their own sexual identity, and two, you get them separated from their parents in an environment around peers, and they will start to reject the beliefs of their parents. And so they know that. And so, you know, things like this, like these questionnaires and everything, I mean, you have situations where children as young as 7 or 8 years old are being told by homosexual activists who come into the classroom, you know, if you're a boy, well, you don't like girls, then you must, you might be homosexual. Or if you're a girl and you don't like boys, well, you must be a lesbian. Well, at age 8, you know, you don't like the members of the opposite sex. And you start feeding that in there. And then in the teenage years, they come in, and which is an age of great sexual confusion, and continue to plant this seed, which just leads to sexual confusion, you know, at a time when kids are going through all sorts of changes and, you know, establishing their sexual identity. And you plant these seeds, and ultimately, in many cases, it leads the child into a life of homosexual behavior.
I was a little shocked when I saw that Newton, Massachusetts, the homosexual rainbow flag is flown proudly at many schools, and many of the same schools have chosen to ignore the Massachusetts law that the American flag be displayed on school grounds, but they'll have the rainbow flag of homosexuality there.
Oh yes, and this is and just in San Francisco, they've got, you know, first and second graders making, you know, the flag for the gay pride parade, you know, in downtown San Francisco. It's just amazing, you know, how they have, you know, gone in there and infiltrated with the full support of organizations like the National Education Association. And of course, the big player here is GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Educational Network, who have specifically targeted young elementary children for homosexual indoctrination.
What is this program called, It's Elementary?
It's Elementary is a video that was done by two lesbian filmmakers out of the San Francisco Bay Area. And basically, the whole video is about how homosexuality is being taught in public schools. And then you've got examples, you know, how Christians are just demonized in this video. You have one little fifth grade boy who's probably been indoctrinated for about 4 or 5 years saying that you know, Christians just want to kill torture and kill homosexuals. There is no, it's just kind of left there standing. There's no rebuttal to it. You have another little girl sharing an essay about her lesbian parents, and the teacher who's in the classroom is obviously homosexual, saying that people who believe, you know, the Bible says homosexual behavior is wrong, are stupid. And this is just all out there in this video. And this is a video that is being used nationwide to train teachers, you know, and school administrators and so forth on how to implement homosexual teaching in the public schools.
And, of course, hasn't the attitude towards homosexuality dramatically changed here in recent years?
Oh, yes, it has. I mean, if you look at the polls, I mean, back about 1988 or so, it was, you know, almost 75% of the American public thought homosexual behavior was always wrong. That number is now down to about 54.6%. So this continued drumbeat that, you know, hey, we're just like everybody else, what our behavior is fine, and, you know, and hey, we're the ones that got it together, has really help push public opinion that way. And especially in public schools, you know, we now have a whole generation of kids who are growing up with this indoctrination of homosexual behavior, where now most kids, you know, there's a Zogby poll where the kids who are graduating from high school, two-thirds of them are in support of same-sex marriage. Even 80% of Catholic students were in support of same-sex marriage.
And, of course, this is really following along with this almost like a Mein Kampf written by Kirk and Madsen.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, on page 18, do you have your copy of
the book? Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you just read those things and explain how each one of these has been carried out. There's 6 points that they made. This was how they're going to change America. And I should say how they have changed America.
Mm-hmm.
Pick that story up and follow through with it, would you?
Okay, the first point was talk about gays and gayness as loudly and often as possible, which is what you are seeing in the media on a daily basis, whether it be on network television, on news programs, throughout newspapers, magazines. You can't hardly pick up anything now where there isn't some article about, you know, homosexual behavior, and always in glowing terms. And there's two reasons why they do this. One, to desensitize people, but also, two, to get people, you know, a lot of people going, I'm just so sick and tired of hearing about it. Just give them whatever they want so I don't have to deal with it anymore. Two is to portray gays as victims and not as aggressive challengers, which is with how they try to play themselves as disenfranchised, even though their incomes are double of, you know, normal, you know, average Americans. Basically portray themselves as being discriminated against, or, you know, when something they get an opportunity, like, you know, the Matthew Shepard murder, to basically, you know, use that and use him as a martyr for their cause to demonize Christians. And then they try to make the Christians look like they're the aggressive challengers who are trying to deny their rights, when it's the homosexual activists who are just the relentless, aggressive challengers in all aspects of life to push their agenda. Give homosexual protectors a just cause. They tie in, you know, one, you know, people's sense of fairness by, you know, the whole disenfranchised argument, but also they tapped into liberal America and what I call liberal America guilt. And they have tapped into that and become basically the special interest group of the, you know, the last decade, who needs protection, you know, who needs, normal, you know, parts of society, as, you know, liberals would say that we need to be there and we need to defend them because, you know, they're being persecuted against, or, you know, they don't have the same rights
Okay, so the thing is that the whole idea is to give them special rights that are not available to anybody else, so that you must fire them, or you must hire them, or, you know, if you were to discriminate, and all they have to do is say, well, I'm gay, I was discriminated against, I want $1 million, and they can destroy any employer in this state.
Yes, they can do that. In fact, you know, in California, you're aware of AB 196, I'm sure, where... it was signed by, you know, the former governor, Gray Davis, now, several months ago, where if you own a Bible bookstore and a person comes in, and it's your Bible bookstore and you run it on a for-profit basis, and someone comes in and they apply for a job, and this person is a transsexual, and you say, I'm sorry, I can't hire you because your behavior violates, you know, the moral beliefs and religious beliefs of this business. That person can now basically bring you up on charges, and your Bible bookstore could be fined up to $150,000 for not hiring someone because they are a transsexual, which basically would put any small businessman out of business. And so, but basically, so when we say give homosexual protectors a just cause, they basically have bought, you know, allowed, you know, for liberals, you know, the whole special rights thing, special protections, just as like they basically tied in to a lot of the legitimate civil rights movements that, and have piggybacked on that and are now using that as a weapon against Christians. The fourth one is make gays look good, which is you'll never see a homosexual portrayed in a negative light. And the fifth is make the victimizers look bad. Christians are always portrayed, you know, poorly, and the only time a Christian might be portrayed good is if they have, you know, quote, seen the light and have come to embrace, you know, acceptance of homosexual behavior, if you ever watch media portrayals. Then the sixth is to solicit funds. The buck stops here, and that's where they got into corporate America. And basically, we have a twofold strategy. It's very interesting. On one hand, they go to corporate America and say, we're disenfranchised. We don't, you know, we're discriminated against. You need to give us, you know, special protections. You need to give us domestic partner benefits and all this. On the other hand, they go to corporate America and say, look how much money we have. Look at all the disposable income we have. You should be marketing to us because we'll bring all this business to you. And so there's a duplicity there that they've gotten corporate America to sign on. I mean, you listed earlier American Airlines. I mean, United Airlines. For example, United Airlines gives three years of free travel to the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, which goes around advocating same-sex marriage. You know, and we say in the book, if they'd given 3 years of free travel to focus on the family, I mean, United Airlines would have had every, you know, negative media, they would have been stigmatized so bad. But they can give, you know, 3 years of free travel to the nonprofit organization, you know, the organization that wants to destroy marriage in America.
Well, there's so many things that are going on today. But, of course, none of this could really happen without tremendous funding from corporate America,
yes,
from the great tax-exempt foundations, and from the media, because the power of the gays has never really been their own power. It's always been that of the people who control the media, who are doing everything they can to encourage homosexuality, because it, of course, is stimulating the moral breakdown of America and our nation as a whole.
Yes, in fact, homosexual activists often work hand-in-hand with, you know, what I guess I would call heterosexual activists who want basically all sexual boundaries eliminated. So it's an anything-goes society. These quote, sexual behavior advocates, they realize that once you start getting homosexuality legitimized, then, you know, things like polygamy and every other sexually deviant behavior will start to be accepted as well. And we're seeing that in Europe, and with this latest decision from the United States Supreme Court, we've already seen child pornographers trying to take advantage of it, saying, well, hey, if it's sexual behavior, it should be protected by the right of privacy. So they work very much hand in hand.
And, of course, the great tragedy is, of course, America, which was once a moral nation, America, which once could handle matters of pornography and homosexuality at the local level, now has been stripped of that right by a Supreme Court, which is pro-homosexual, which has their own agenda, and one only has to see what's happened since 1962 to realize, of course, that their agenda is the destruction of the Christian foundation of this country. The Supreme Court justices were put there because they were anti-Christian. They've been appointed by presidents who knew exactly where they were coming from. They just didn't want the American people to know that. And that's what's so frightening. Seven of our Supreme Court justices were appointed by Republican presidents, and they tell us we have to get a Republican in there or else we'll get that terrible Al Gore and he'll put in terrible Supreme Court justices. You would think that some people might learn after a while that maybe we've been lied to. Well, now, Craig, as you talk about this across America, what sort of response do you get from people? Are they tend to agree with you, or are people saying, well, you know, you're intolerant, or you're homophobic, or I love that word, homophobe. They created that word out of thin air, and now it's part of the vernacular.
Yeah, they created that as their term to stigmatize anybody who didn't, you know, affirm homosexual behavior. It's been very interesting. Of course, you know, our book is available on Amazon.com, and they post reviews, and it's very much, you can see the culture war played out on the reviews there. And very much, it's very interesting when you see the negative reviews from the homosexual activists. It's like they never read the book. They just throw out the usual homophobic bigots and all this stuff. And well, the people who have read it have said, oh, yikes, there's something going on here. We had one guy who put a review on there and said, you know, up until I read this book, I didn't believe this junk, is basically how he said it. But now I do. I see where things are going and everything, and these guys know what they're talking about. It's been very interesting as I've talked to people, you know, in the church very much. You know, they'll say, you know, I kind of suspected this was going on, but I really didn't know, and I didn't know how far the homosexual movement had advanced. And I think some people are slowly beginning to wake up. After that absolutely tragic Supreme Court decision, we did see a significant swing in the polls more towards the more traditional view on things as people started to see, yikes, they are going to go after marriage. And what these people have been saying all these years, maybe there was some validity to it. Now, rather, you know, people still will have the backbone to stand up and for traditional values and for, you know, for Scripture is, you know, yet to be seen.
Well, it's going to be very interesting. And how many copies have you had this out? How long has it been out?
This book came out the end of June. It's already in its second printing. We've probably sold about, well over 20,000 copies, which is pretty good for a book. We are, you know, this is the book they tell you you can't sell, and it's done surprisingly well through word of mouth and, you know, basically also the fact that I think the church is beginning to wake up that, you know, the line is now on the doorstep, and he can't be ignored anymore.
The lion's already in the house. And
well, it's in the house, yes. But now, how do we get him out of the house? And it's going to be awfully difficult.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I think it's so vitally important that I think the book is well worthwhile. Now, how can people get copies of the book? The book is, of course, called The Homosexual Agenda, Exposing the Principal Threat to Religious Freedom. Today it's by Alan Sears and Craig Austin. Craig is our guest. How can people get your book?
They can go to the Lifeway.com website.
Lifeway.
Mm-hmm. Or they can go to AllianceDefenseFund.org and order it there. And it should be available in many Christian bookstores as well.
All right, fine. I saw a big pile of these at a meeting I was at about a week ago, and I picked one up. And I of course, also, your publisher was kind enough to send me a copy as well. So I've got two copies, and I think it's well worthwhile reading. Very, very well done. We'll be back here in just a moment, and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Remember, there's no instance in all history where a nation has embraced homosexuality where that nation has survived. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I want to remind you, of course, that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that some of you out there in the listening audience will feel strongly enough about what's going on that you'll decide to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, which is what allows us to be on the air 5 hours every day, our weekend program to be heard on 35 stations, and, of course, we can continue expanding only with your help, but certainly through shortwave and the internet, through satellite, through radio, we are reaching ever more people. And people are certainly anxious for the truth, and they're not going to get it from Rush Limbaugh, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, or certainly Barbara Walters. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV. War. And then, of course, we want to mention that we're going to be having an all-day seminar out at the Aptos Seascape here and Aptos in the Santa Cruz area. That's going to be on the 29th of November. It's going to be starting at 8:30 in the morning. Doors will open at 8 o'clock. And, of course, it's going to go through till 5 in the evening. There's going to be a luncheon served. And, of course, if you want to go, you're going to have reservations ahead of time. And we hope many of you will call 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We're going to bring in all sorts of speakers, have a great time, and we did this last year, and I think at the end of the day, why everybody was sorry that the day was over. So if you'd like to come, we're going to talk about the Patriot Act, we're going to talk about the church growth movement, we're going to talk about the war in Iraq, we're going to talk about Christian persecution. Bill Sauter is going to talk on health matters. And please give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 to get in your reservations or find out about, of course, the expenses of it. And then, of course, you can send a check to Post Office Box 969, Soquel, California, 95073. That's Post Office Box 969, Soquel, California, 95073. And, of course, we hope to see you there. We hope that you'll tell your friends and relatives about the meeting, because this is the time when people have to begin to understand what's really going on. And until you understand that we have a small group that controls our government that is dedicated to perpetual war, that the war in Iraq is not the end, it's simply the beginning of a series of conflicts in the Middle East that may very well end up in either bankrupting or destroying America. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening, Craig Austin, his book, and he and Alan Sears wrote this together, The Homosexual Agenda. It simply takes a great deal of material from homosexual publications telling exactly what they were going to do and how they were going to manipulate the American public and manipulate the situation, and they've just followed through with their Mein Kampf. In fact, they even talk about Adolf Hitler and, of course, his book, Mein Kampf, and, of course, they are doing exactly what Adolf Hitler did in Hitler's Germany. What most Americans don't understand is that the movement that brought Hitler to power was a homosexual movement. Ernst Röhm, the brown shirts were predominantly homosexuals. And, of course, we never talk about that here in the United States. But the similarities between what happened in Hitler's Germany and the spiritual forces which were there really are frightening in their similarity. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you would like to give us a call, if you agree, if you disagree, give us a call here at Radio Liberty. A question or comment for Craig Austin. Now, of course, you point out that homosexuality is not certainly something people is born with. It's a choice. Would you like to develop that idea?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, first of all, I do personally know several former homosexuals. And when you do talk to them, they can pinpoint to what led them to initially fall into homosexual behavior. Rather, it was, you know, abuse from an older person at an early age, sexual abuse, or rather it was attaching to the wrong parent. John Paul, who I write about, John's a very, you know, good friend of mine, I've known John for years, will say quite plainly, what happened was he never knew his father. He attached to his mother, and that led to, led him down the road into homosexual behavior. You know, it's very interesting, the studies they try to come up with to produce, you know, to say homosexual behavior is genetic. None of them, you know, when you look, for, you know, past the surface, have been used with any legitimate research method. We talk about in the book some of the studies, and these are the ones that are dealing with same-sex adoption, a lot of them. You know, when I looked at them, I'm going, this is something I learned in my first year of college in a, you know, in a research class, you know, principles that they've just totally ignored in doing these studies. And the other thing is, it's very interesting, you'll see a lot of people who have been prominent homosexuals flip and go the other way. Like you think of Anne Heche, who was running around with Ellen DeGeneres and saying she loved Ellen and totally embraced lesbian behavior, and now is married and has a child, and now she says, no, I was just kind of delusional during that period. So regardless of, you know, what they want to prove, you know, all signs point to that homosexual behavior is a learned behavior. In fact, they even will admit that at times. For example, in this report that they did for the National, you know, the National Education Association is using in public schools to silence Christians on homosexual behavior, they say right out, you know, sexual orientation is fluid. You could be heterosexual for a while. You could be homosexual for a while. Well, if that's the case, that's not something you were born with.
Well, you know, you talk about Fred Phelps there, and we've had some experience with Fred Phelps. You know, this is a man who, along with members of his church, puts out some violently anti-gay material. It's almost as if he is a caricature of Christianity there, not to, of course, oppose the homosexual movement, but, of course, demonize Christianity as such. Have you ever had that thought?
Well, you know, we've kind of thought, you know, you talked about it, it's like, you know, you start to think, you know, you wonder if Fred Phelps, you know, that there's something behind it, because he is exactly the type of figure that the homosexual activists, I mean, he is such, you know, want to point to as, you know, this absolutely hateful Christian here who does all these evil things. And you start, you know, after a while, you start to think, I wonder if there's something going on behind us. And I can't say that or whatever, but, you know, he's done things, you know, even, you know, picketed Focus on the Family because they had some former homosexuals on staff who are now people who are working to share the truth about homosexual behavior.
And, you know, a big signs, all God hates fags, and all fags are going to burn in hell, and everything to really inflame the whole situation. And having talked to this man, he certainly doesn't manifest any Christian virtue.
No, we repudiate that. I mean, that is, you know, that is unfortunately the type of behavior. Rather, you know, there's things going behind the scenes that we don't know about or whatever. But that is not the gospel of Jesus Christ either. I mean, the gospel of Jesus Christ is love and bringing the sinner to repentance and to healing. And that type of behavior does more damage than can be believed. And we, you know, we totally disagree. God loves the homosexual. Because he loves them, he wants them to be healed of their behavior and to come to faith in him.
Well, you know, I think the most amazing thing is that homosexuals can change, and I've known several of them. And, you know, they're really a very very, very talented, very capable, very nice people. And, of course, you know, when you sit down and talk to them, actually they're very, very masculine, the two that I'm thinking of. You know, and, of course, they're totally dedicated to helping others out of this lifestyle, which they realize is so destructive. And yet, of course, when you are homosexual and you live the lifestyle, they will come after you and do everything they can to destroy you.
Oh, yes. I mean, I've seen what's happened to John Polk throughout the years. And John is one of the nicest guys you'd ever want to meet. And, you know, John has just had every vicious attack against him because he came out of a homosexual lifestyle and he felt he was called to minister to the others and to lead others out of the homosexual lifestyle. And as a result, he's had so many death threats against him, and death threats even against his small children, because of the stance he's taken.
Is he still working at Focus on the Family?
No, John left about 6 months ago.
Okay.
And I think I think John, after all the years of everything, has just needed to take a step back and have some time just to not be in the limelight for a while.
Well, it's a rough time, and certainly it takes a lot of courage not only to come out of the lifestyle, but then to try to help others, because they target you, and they really are vicious, vicious. I know many years ago I was involved in the battle to try to address the AIDS epidemic and save the lives of both homosexuals and heterosexuals getting this disease. And everybody who was in that battle with me had their lives destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And they were targeted, and they went after them, and they destroyed them. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And yet, of course, none of this has ever been picked up by the media.
Oh, none of it has ever been picked up that way. And I've seen the same behavior. And I remember, you know, I was used to be a Focus on the Family, and I was there right after Amendment 2 passed and saw all the absolute vicious things that happened.
Why don't you explain to our listeners who don't know what Amendment 2 is?
Amendment 2 was passed by the voters in Colorado in November 1992, and basically Amendment 2 said, you know, prohibited the state from, you know, and city and county governments from giving special rights to homosexuals. It did not deny them any of the rights they already had, but it was basically to preempt any push from homosexual activists for affirmative action, all these other items. Well, immediately, Colorado was deemed the hate state, and homosexual activists, you know, again, just totally distorted the argument. I mean, no one was denying, you know, homosexuals any rights at all, and totally distorted the argument, and Focus on the Family, which was not even the organization that wrote the amendment and put it on the ballot. Yes, Focus supported it. Was just the target of everything. And the spiritual warfare I saw during that time, you know, the attacks against Focus on the Family employees in the city, the whole media turned against them, the physical destruction of property, just the vandalism, the relentless attacks within the community, and the absolute vilatric speech. There would be flyers on the polls around downtown Colorado Springs, it basically said, bring back the lions, let's throw these Christians to the lions.
Well, of course, but this wasn't getting into the media. We weren't hearing about that because, of course, homosexuals are supposed to be loving. And if the American people really realized how vitriolic some of these people are and how really angry they are and how destructive they are and how they will conspire to destroy people's reputation and jobs and families and harass them with telephone calls.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all blacked out by the media.
It is. That is never reported. And, you know, as we used to sit there and go, you know, where is the hate coming from? And the hate was all coming from one side. And that's one reason why a lot of people, they're scared to death of this issue, because even the few that have seen that go, I don't want to bring this upon me and my family. And it's really, it takes a lot of courage to venture into this area.
Either that or, you know, what do they say? Who rushes in where angels fear to tread? Mm-hmm. Be that as it may. I certainly appreciate your effort and Alan's effort to bring this information forward. Now, of course, this permeates every aspect of our society, and mm-hmm. a really powerful influence within the media, within Hollywood. And you, in your book, you talk about the influence in Hollywood. Would you like to sort of develop that idea?
Yeah, I mean, right, and you know, as we talk about in book in the whole thing in Hollywood, what's been going on in Hollywood is not something that just kind of happened in the last 5 years. I'm a student of the movies. I love old movies, and as I went back and studied these things, the homosexuals have always had a presence in Hollywood, but it used to be in a way where there might be just a little joke sneaked in here, something that most people would think was harmless. But basically, starting about 30 years ago, the homosexual activists really started pushing their agenda. And, you know, one of the first things they did was start making movies about how corrupt the American family was and how, you know, underneath, you know, this, you know, wonderful surface, there's all these, you know, dysfunctional behaviors going on in the American family. So you start destroying the family in movies like Who Was Afraid of Virginia Woolf or Divorce America Style, all these movies. You start destroying the family as the fundamental institution of society and plant that seed in people's minds through the media, then you start pushing alternatives. You know, the whole homosexual agenda starts to come in because, you know, the media in Hollywood has now undermined the moral basis for society. And then they went through television programs, even as early as the 1970s, starting to push their agenda. And we've just seen the escalation since then. So this has been a long, long thought out strategy.
What about Alfred Kinsey? What part does he play in this?
Well, what Kinsey did was he did a study that basically where he came out and said that, you know, his study said 10% of, you know, individuals are homosexual. And the homosexual activists have known that this figure is a lie, but they continue to use it. I mean, no legitimate study shows it really. Even the most generous study says 3% at most. But, you know, Kinsey's whole study was filled with people who engaged in sexually deviant behavior. Whether it was pedophiles or homosexuals, whatever. His sample was just absolutely corrupt. It was geared to reach this conclusion, to undermine or create confusion in Americans about, you know, the sexual, you know, about our sexuality. And so interesting, homosexual activists will say, we know the 10% figure is a lie, but they push it, and in many, you know, state of Minnesota, their publications, you know, and quote, diversity and, you know, tolerance, I'll say homosexuals are 10% of the population. There's a program in schools called Project 10. Because, you know, well, 10%, if 10% of the population is homosexual, then 10% of the kids in school must be homosexual. And they keep pushing this, and sometimes even adding to that number. I had one friend who works for American Express who was forced to go to one of these things, and he was told that homosexuals now make up 11% of the population.
It's growing.
Yeah, it's growing, and it's a flat-out lie based on fraudulent research to begin with.
And, of course, Kinsey himself was a pedophile. He was a homosexual,
right.
You know, or at least bisexual. He was into masochism. I mean, he was a real pervert, and, of course, he falsified all of his data.
He falsified it, and his sample was so skewed to begin with. I mean, he set out with an agenda to try to, you know, and he, you know, came up with a study that, you know, that would back his agenda.
And of course, really what I think really has been missed by so many people is that the whole thing was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Rockefellers have been involved with the occult and with the depraved, for 100 years, generation after generation after generation, intent upon, of course, undermining the moral fabric of our society. Old Winthrop Rockefeller had the biggest pornography of the collection of the world. Lawrence was funding the writings of Barbara Marx Hubbard, who was, of course, getting books channeled to her by a demonic spirit. And you go right down the line of these people. They give depravity a bad name. But we don't understand that it was their funding that funded, of course, Alfred Kinsey. And, of course, that was what then began to change the moral structure of our society. And his fraudulent research then was used as the basis for changing our moral laws. Isn't that right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's amazing, you know, the influence this fraudulent research has had on our country's entire moral fabric.
And, of course, you know, when Kinsey was involved with the Nazi head of one of the Nazi war camps, who was, you know, sexually molesting the children and torturing the children sexually. And that was on the front pages of every newspaper in Germany for weeks on end, never once mentioned in newspapers in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So it just simply reflects the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. Well, what can we do? How can we begin to approach this? How can we counter them when they control the media, when they have the backing of some of the wealthiest corporations and the most, certainly the large tax-exempt foundations? And, of course, most of our churches are just struggling along trying to survive economically.
It's going to be very difficult. I mean, first of all, we need to pray. But second of all, I mean, Christians need to become educated on this issue and what's going on, which is the reason we wrote the book. You know, regardless of what has gone on, there is still people in our country, and even if they're not Christians, who have a strong moral basis that homosexual behavior and the promotion of it is, you know, they know is wrong. But unfortunately, you know, as they've seen, standing up to that, there is a cost to be paid. And one, I think we need to become educated. The people in the churches need to know this is what's going on. This is how it's going to affect your religious freedom, the religious freedom for your children and grandchildren. Joe Dallas, a former homosexual, has said, homosexual activists, you can give them everything they want. They will not be satisfied until the church is silenced on this issue. And we need to wake people up to that fact. And then people need to become mobilized. And it's going to be at the grassroots level, and it's not going to be easy. But we have to remember, Christ paid the ultimate price for us, and if we're going to be able to share his love and the gospel with future generations, and to be able to share the gospel with the person who's trapped in homosexual behavior, we're going to have to swallow hard and maybe pay a price and stand up to what's going on out there.
Well, I can see the time when it's going to be a federal crime to say that homosexuality is wrong.
Well, it's, because we're seeing that happening in Canada, and the homosexual activists are very open in saying, hey, what's happening in Canada is going to happen here. And people seem beginning to see a little bit that's happening in Canada, and they're getting alarmed, and at least I think a small number of people are beginning to wake up to it. Now, rather, we're going to have the courage to stand up to it, or we're just going to say, well, I don't like it. We're turning into, have people come and say, we're turning into Sodom and Gomorrah, but I feel helpless to do anything about it. But that is coming. I mean, through, hate crimes laws and things like that, where, being able to share what the Bible says about homosexual behavior will be criminalized. I mean, in Canada, there is a bill that is just about passed that even the Canadian Bible Society, which is not a group that is seen as a, quote, right-wing, fundamentalist group, that sky is falling type of organization, as so often groups that sound the alarm on these issues are depicted, even within the church, are saying this thing is going to be used as a weapon to silence Christians and to silence the church and to censor certain parts of the Bible.
Well, of course, the thing is that God is not going to be mocked. We can talk about the legal implications.
Right.
We can talk about the Supreme Court. But how does God feel about it? And that's the question that nobody really wants to ask. And how long will God be patient? and what will happen when he intervenes. I would think that would put the fear of God into the homosexuals if they realized that if they really understood that, you know, God is going to intervene and they're going to be the subject of his wrath.
It should put the fear of God in all of us because, you know, and, but yes, I mean, and I think that motivates them. I think they know that their behavior is an abomination to God. They know their behavior is sinful, but they have to basically, I don't know how else to put it, numb themselves to the point and just keep going on in the behavior they are. And, you know, deep down, they know that there is going to be a price to be paid someday.
Well, you know, there's one line from Gods and Generals, and incidentally, if our listeners haven't seen that, it's available on DVD now. It's well worthwhile. But there's one point where, you know, Stonewall Jackson makes the remark about what we need in the Army is men who fear God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is what we really need in America today is men who fear God and are willing to take a stand. Because if there's no fear of God, then we will continue going exactly the way we're going today.
Yes, we will. If we, you know, unfortunately in America we have gotten so comfortable, we have forgotten, you know, we have forgotten the fear of God. And we've forgotten about the fear of God in our churches. And, you know, we do need a dose of that. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, of course, what we do here 5 hours a day is try to make people understand that behind all the things that are going on, all the plans of men and demons, there is, of course, there is this demonic force in work, and, of course, God is there as well. And we want to be sure that we're on the right side in this spiritual battle. Well, we're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
My closing thought is that, you know, the picture may look bleak. You know, we've painted all these things that are going on out there. But if God's people will rise up, they will pray, they will take action, and they will do it in a way that communicates God's love, but also, you know, God's, you know, tough love towards the person who's trapped in sin, and especially, you know, in this particular case, homosexual behavior, things can turn around in this country and in our culture. But it's going to be up to us as the people of God to be willing to take the stand and to do the things we need to do. Whether it's, you know, working through the legal arena as we do at the Alliance Defense Fund, working and impacting the culture, whatever. The hour may look late, but if we cry out to God, ask for his help, and ask him to embolden us and to strengthen us, we can still turn this around.
Amen to that. Well, thank you so very much. Please give my best to Alan Sears. And would you be willing to come on as a guest on some of our other programs?
Anytime. It would be my pleasure.
All right, fine. Is there any way we can get in touch with you directly, or do we have to go through your creative resources there?
If you want to get in touch with me, you can call me at the Alliance Defense Fund.
All right, fine. That's what we'll do. And so thank you very much. I have that number there.
Okay.
Anyway, God bless you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and I really think that it's an excellent, excellent book. They've got a lot of material, and they've simply organized it in a way that I haven't seen anybody else do it. Again, the book is The Homosexual Agenda. If you need to know more about it, we can tell you how to get it. And then, of course, we want to remind you that we will be having our all-day seminar on the 29th of November, and we hope that many of you will want to come. And you can, if you want to put in your reservation right now, and we have to have advanced reservations, please call 1-800-544-8927. We have to know how many people are there because we have to order lunches, and I think it'll be a great day. I'm looking forward to it. I hope you will as well. So this is Dr. Stan saying, good night, and may the Lord be with you. We'll be with you again on next Monday. Until then, never forget that between man's plan and time and God's plan and eternity, there is an infinite quality of difference.